Hi, and welcome to episode number 92 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. I am Francis Campoy, and I'm here with my colleague Mark Mandel. Hey Mark, how are you doing?
I'm very excited, because after this we're going to have lunch.
Yes, me too. So hungry right now. Also excited because we're going to be talking to Mackie Will, who works at a company called Phoenix One, and they do video games.
Yes, one of my favorite topics. He has a really cool story about basically how he took his whole infrastructure from on-prem, so dedicated hardware, brought it all over to the cloud. Basically, it's an almost direct lift and shift. It's pretty cool. He got some benefits, and he had to learn some lessons, and he's going to share them all with us.
Yeah, also very cool guy. He's definitely a geek into hardware stuff, so interesting to hear his experience of moving from I know every single piece of hardware I'm running to I'm running on the cloud.
Yep,
very cool. And then at the end, we'll have a question of the week, which is about security. Security on App Engine. How do you make sure that only who you want to use a web page are able to use that web page?
Ooh.
Yeah, magic. Magic is one of the options indeed. And before that, we have the cool things of the week. One of them, and I'm going to go with it because it involves not only App Engine, but also Go, is the New York Times. They wrote, so J.P. Robinson, which is a principal software engineer at the New York Times, also a user of Go and lover of cats, wrote,
that's the important bit.
That's his bio.
Yep.
Wrote a very cool blog post explaining how the New York Times migrated their crossword page from, I think they were using a LAMP-like architecture, they say. I don't know exactly what they mean by that. But they migrated the whole thing to App Engine running in Go, and they explain how happy they are about it. It's very cool because they actually give a decent amount of technical detail. It's not only about like, we moved. They also talk about how they do monitoring and alerting, how they use PubSub in order to do like push style for subscriptions and things like this. It's very interesting. A lot of detail. Check it out. I think it's definitely worth reading.
Yeah, they do some interesting stuff around autoscaling, which I thought was interesting. But I think the real takeaway here was they managed to cut their infrastructure costs in half.
Yeah.
Doing this. So I thought that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, there's a line basically saying that their previous setup and a cloud provider competitor was not elastic enough, and that App Engine actually fixed this because it's able to scale up and down super fast and super easily. So definitely check it out. And if you have some similar case, like you have huge peaks of traffic followed by no one using your app, it's definitely worth to have a look at how App Engine handles auto-scaling.
Absolutely. So the second cool thing of the week, I'm kind of excited by it. It's probably a bit nerdy, but it's kind of cool. We just announced, now it is alpha, so you need to get whitelisted for it. I'll say that up at front. But we just announced network service tiers, which I think is super, super cool. So one of the things with Google Cloud is we run our own network, right? It's the same network that we run for Gmail and Maps and for everything, right? This is super fast and super great, except for the fact it is kind of expensive.
Yeah.
Because we run our own hardware and like we do a lot of cool stuff for you. Sometimes, though, you don't want that super fast network. You want something that's maybe fairly similar to what some other cloud providers have, right, who don't run their own networks, and you wanted a cheaper price point. So now we have this thing called network service tiers, such that you can have either the standard, which is our premium tier, where you have like great consistency, great speed, everything else, and then you have the standard tier, which uses much more of the public internet, much less of our network, but that does mean that you're paying a whole lot less. So maybe if you're moving files, like large files from one place to another, but you don't really care how quickly they get there, like if they get there in the next day or so, it's fine. So you don't have to pay those huge egress costs if you're moving them from, say, a data center to us or back again, all sorts of things like that. That means then, you don't care as much about latency, you don't care about necessarily about consistency because it is over the public internet. You can save yourself some money. So it's actually really, really cool. I'm actually really excited about this.
Cool. I like that it's actually configured, I see, at a resource level. So you can definitely, you can basically decide for every instance or instance template or load balancer into what network tier you're going to be using that. So it's not like all in, all out. You could be like, well, you know, it's like for this specific thing, I need to be really fast. So I'm going to go with premium. But this other thing, like it's a MapReduce that might take longer. I don't care. Then you can go with
the right network for the right job.
Yeah. Very, very cool. And also, saving money, which, you know, I like that. And then we have the last cool thing of the week. Actually, there were way too many cool things of the week, but the last one we chose, it's about Titan, which both of you and I have one on our desk.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. So Titan is a really cool microchip that Google designed specifically for Google purpose-built servers. So it's something that we run internally at Google and on Google Cloud too, and allows us to do really cool security things that without this kind of hardware, you would not be able to do it. So there's a new blog post that covers Titan in depth. It's definitely in depth. It's a pretty long one, but you will be able to understand not only what are the basics, like what is Titan and how it's built, like from a basic point of view, but also what it empowers us to do and what kind of security we can manage. Like, for instance, make sure that if someone accesses something, we're able to see it and the logging cannot be tampered with. Stuff like that, like really, really powerful things explained in a lot of detail. And if you are interested in knowing more, but you're too lazy to read, like me, you can also listen to the episode that we did back in March with the final day at Cloud Next, which was episode 67, where we interviewed Cornelius Willis, which is the head marketing Google Cloud Platform, and Neil Mueller, which is our product marketing lead also at Google Cloud. And they told us a little bit about it. It is a very cool thing and goes very well on your earrings, apparently.
Yeah. No, yeah. I love this. I just goes to show, I think, what levels we go to as a company to ensure security, that we write these chips ourselves, build these chips ourselves, make these chips ourselves such that we can be like, these machines are ours. The software that's running on them is ours. Everything that's happening on this machine has not been tampered with in any way, shape, or form. And we make sure that we own that from end to end. And that's like, yay, security, yay.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing, but at the same time, incredibly important to make sure that your workloads are running where you really think they are running.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, very cool.
Awesome. All right, well, why don't we go have a chat with Michael Will, talk to him about his game Guardian Kingdoms.
Sounds good. Let's do that.
So it is an absolute pleasure today to join one of my friends on stage from New York, Michael Will, Director of Technical Operations at Phoenix One Games. Michael, how are you doing today?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Thank you so much for joining us, coming to talk to us about Phoenix One Games, your newly released game, Guardian Kingdoms. I don't know if you can still count it as new anymore, that you have on mobile. But before we get stuck into that and how you use Google Cloud Platform, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what do you do at Phoenix One Games?
Hi, I'm Michael Will. I work at Phoenix One Games as a director of technical operations. So I take care of the back end of the game, basically. I have a systems engineering background, hardware. I used to make high-performance compute cluster at Penguin Computing before I went into the gaming industry. And so with that focus, I'm also designing my backend, and we will talk about the details of what that means later.
Cool. So tell us a little bit about Guardian Kingdoms. What it is? What is it?
So Guardian Kingdoms is a real-time strategy game that's similar to Clash of Clans in the sense that you build your own kingdom and you defend it against other people and you build up resources and so on. But what's unique about this is that you actually have massive real-time gameplay with three people on your side, three people on the other side, and all of them drop like hundreds of units, so your battlefield is full of thousands of units moving, and it's pretty exciting.
Cool. So there's basically six players for every game, but every player up to six players.
So the thing is, you are organized in alliances just like you would be in those other games. But the nice thing is that if you get attacked, they all get notifications on their phone and they can actually help you and participate.
Fun.
Or they can just observe. So it's like you might have 10, 15 people observing the game and two people on your side that are supporting you. And that's... they can join at any moment, so it really can turn also the game around, which is fun.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about how it's implemented. Like, it's a mobile game. What runs on the mobile? What runs on the back end? Like, tell us a little bit.
Right. So it's basically a typical client server type multi-tier application. So the phone is your client. It does all the graphics and it connects through HTTPS REST to web farm, if you want, that implements the API for the game. And so anything that your phone client asks of the game first validates. So if you say, I want to spend 50 gold on upgrading this tower, then it will basically verify that you actually have that before it does that. So the battle simulations are actually done on battle servers that are implemented in C++, and we use some artificial intelligence scripting using Lua technology in there. for best performance. And then the backend servers, the web farm, the API basically to the game, that's implemented in PHP.
Cool. So I think the interesting story here is that you used to run basically this whole thing on bare metal. And you did that for quite a while. Can you tell us a bit about like what that experience was like and what you did there?
Yeah, it's more of a hardware systems engineering approach, right? So you basically design web servers, database servers, and so on. And with the servers, you basically look at which ones are most critical, and those you make as redundant as possible inside of the server. So you basically architect for server resiliency. And so for a database server, that means I want to have redundant power supplies so that if one of the power cables gets disconnected by accident or one of the power supplies fails, system keeps running and it can be hot swapped out. And the same goes for a disk drive. So there's hardware RAID, which means you have a bunch of disks, data is redundantly distributed amongst them. And so if one of the disks fails, an operator can replace the disk drive without the system shutting down. And it can just keep writing its data and it will reshuffle the data as a new disk is inserted. So hardware systems engineering focus here is that you actually look into details as like, do I want two RAID controllers for best performance? Do I want to have multiple volumes and stripe across those? And so you can do a lot of optimization there. And you also want to control the firmware and be really very specific about what you end up putting into production that you have tested and you know it works. And so that's the hardware systems engineering focus that you have basically. And what's different now in the cloud is you don't have that access anymore to the detail, which at first seems like a problem, but it actually is a blessing because it allows you to change your approach. So I'm no longer a hardware system engineer, but rather I'm a distributed systems engineer. And so instead of looking at a single server never going down, what I do instead is I look at the servers never going down by having enough servers and having failover built into my software stack.
Cool. So let's dig deeper into that. So you had sort of your hardware. It was kind of working. It seemed to be like it was working. What were the reasons why you actually ended up transferring over to the cloud? I mean, obviously you were talking about moving to more of a software focus, but were there other aspects to that as well?
So a typical problem that a startup like us faces is that we need to match our cost with revenue or potential revenue. Right, so we don't want to overspend basically, because every dollar that we don't spend on unnecessary stuff idling around, we can put towards acquiring more players that actually bring revenue. And so what we found is that with the hardware, it's kind of hard to scale up and down. So we had a nice contract that would allow us to say, okay, we don't need those servers anymore. And then they say, okay, by the end of the month, you stop paying for it. Which is okay, but it's it basically makes you think like, oh, it's the 31st. We really need to cancel the server now. Otherwise, we pay another month for it. And so the other thing is if you want to scale up because you've got more players and the system starts slowing down and you're like, oh, I need 20 more web servers, they can give them to you in 2 days. But then you're vetting them for another week and reject some, get some replacements and get some miscommunication cleared up. And by the end, it's 2 weeks. So especially if it's database servers, you will definitely need 2 weeks to put them into production. And so that's rather slow moving. And so the promise of the cloud, of course, is that you can spin up stuff in minutes and shut it back down and that you only pay for it when you use it.
Cool. So I'm wondering, you give a little bit of the reasoning behind moving to the cloud, but how easy or hard was it? Like, did you need to rewrite many things or basically all of the things that you had already just worked?
It's basically super easy because we were already a Linux-focused open source architecting shop, right? So everything we did was Lampstack, basically. Originally, we did really use Linux, MySQL, Memcache, and that kind of stuff. And then we replaced MySQL and Memcache with Couchbase at some point to have less dependency on individual servers going down. Remember the original problem? And so that all translates very well into running it on the cloud because it's also Linux and I can use the same services as before. So one important piece for PHP developers is knowing how does my code perform or in general, right? So if a request comes in, I want to have a feel for why a login is slower or what are the slowest requests that I need to focus on. And so we use a service that's called New Relic that basically is like PHP Xdebug, but without the crazy tools that take up all your engineering time to evaluate what you found. And so what it allows you is basically see statistics in real time, basically see, oh yeah, for some reason logins got slower and purchases of this one item are really slow. And then you see stack traces of the actual execution of the code. You can see, oh, we did 1,000 gets on Couchbase. I thought we were just going to do 10. Let me look at the code and fix this. So we can use the same servers like we used to before. So it's drop in the same kind of stuff.
Cool. So which actual GCP products are you using then?
So we use basically Compute Engine, because for me, as somebody who used to be obsessive about firmware on individual components, it's basically, okay, I have to let go of this micromanaging a little bit. And the first step is replicating the same architecture on the cloud. So I can basically have a load balancer. I have my web servers. I have my battle servers. I have Couchbase. And whatever services I use, like Vertica is another database that we use for analytics. And we use Redis for matchmaking and that kind of stuff. That all runs the same way. And the way we deployed is with Chef, and that used to be the same on the hardware as it is now, except for it's much more flexible and goes faster, and I can do it with less impact on the cost.
So now I'm wondering, you were talking about how like much of like how passionate you were about hardware. moving into the cloud, were you like, did you use custom machines? Because, you know, it was like you can tune exactly how much RAM, how many CPUs and stuff like that you used, or what kind of instances did you move to?
I basically maximized memory for the database servers and compute there too, basically to not be bottlenecked. And basically the approach is get the maximum first and then tune it down later as you notice what you really need.
I think when we talked previously, you got some nice notifications from us saying that maybe you want to lower some usage there.
Right. So, I mean, the tools that Google built are just great, and especially in comparison to other cloud vendors. I have to say that's really been one of the reasons why we went with Google, is how quickly we were able to bring up a prototype and then say, hey, that prototype, we will actually turn into production. Can we do this tomorrow kind of thing? And so one of the tools is the web interface, where you can basically customize your own machines, and it even teaches you on how to use it in automated case. There's a little button that you can click, and then you see what the rest call would have been to achieve what you're trying to do.
Super useful.
So the same web interface also shows you which machines that you are running are underutilized, and it actually gives you recommendations on paring it down to save money, which is kind of cool. So it shows you, oh yeah, you have only been using 20% of RAM of this machine. Why don't you use a custom machine, and you can save like $50 a month on this machine.
Cool. You mentioned that for the database instances, you were maximizing RAM. What about storage?
Storage, well, you pay per gigabyte, right? So originally, I also maximized that until I realized the cost impact to its fullest. I mean, we did back-of-the-hand calculations originally, but it really is a different mix of cost that you have to be aware of, especially if you plan to do what we are doing, which is have some of the instances turned off. So they actually you don't get billed for the CPU time at all, but you can bring them up really fast without having to reinstall everything on them. And the storage that's attached, however, is going to be billed as if it is running, because it is occupying the space.
Yeah.
Right. So you pay for what you're using, basically.
But were you using, for the storage, were you using persistent disks, or what kind of disks were you using?
So Couchbase uses network-attached persistent disks, so SSDs for lowest latency, highest IOPS was the goal. And then we use your Google servers called Google Storage in order to do backups. So instead of having a separate file server like we used to do, we now basically just drop it onto Google Storage, which is really easy to use also with the tools that you have. Besides the web interface, there's a command line interface that's really easy to integrate into your scripts.
Yeah.
So I just run like a few lines of shellcode, and basically I can spool data from one system to the other with it. So what I'm doing is the battle servers, they log out like the actions that happened and when people dropped what and so on. And all this data is basically just a big, large file. And I just have a cron script running that pushes, that drops it into a directory on Google Storage. And then I have a different system that, again, in a cron job, just takes everything that it finds there and then takes it apart and inserts it into Vertica as comma separated value files, which gives you the highest throughput.
Actually, you just brought up Vertica, which is, I know, like a big data processing tool.
Yeah, it's like BigQuery, but it's for a smaller capacity if you want. It's basically a relational database that's column-oriented. That means inserts are really slow, but selects are super fast. So if I run a query on a billion rows, I can get a response in under 2 seconds, sometimes under 1 second.
And that's used more for analytics on what happened previously before, so it's not real
time.
Right,
it's an offline thing. So basically the game emits events like, oh, player X purchased this or did that action or tried to cheat or whatever we detect right in the game, and it basically gets collected and then we run analytics on it. We also use an external service called Periscope for basically graphing that kind of stuff. So you can have your queries in there and get nice dashboards, and it basically talks directly to our Vertica backend.
Cool. I have so many questions right now.
Hey, let's do it.
The first question that I have is, okay, so you're using SSDs to store the database, but you're also storing some of that information into cloud storage. Then you read from cloud storage, kind of like MapReduce style or whatever, like a big batch process, and then you store that into Vertica. Is that correct?
That's kind of how it is, in terms of getting analytics data into a queryable system.
Once it's in Vertica, you're actually storing again on SSDs, so the access is really fast. Is that
right?
Okay, cool. So my questions are...
and then RAM, of course, because the Vertica servers have lots of RAM.
In order to make it actually fast.
Yes.
So my first question is, when you're storing on cloud storage, then it means that basically you read it only once and then you just leave it there forever. Are you using something like Nearline or Coldline, or have you considered these things?
We have considered it, but time is precious. So what we do is basically we just have it on whatever the default was at the time, and then we will tune that later. The main cost really is in the actual SSDs, the network attached disk drives, more than the Nearline storage, if you want.
Cool. And then the second question is, since you're doing that offline batching process, how are you doing those? Is that also machines running on GCE or?
Yep, everything there runs on GCE.
And whenever you're doing something offline, my question is always the same. Are you using preemptible machines or, again, it's something that you might consider later on?
Beats me. I mean, I want the systems to be as up, as reliable as possible. That's still the system engineer talking, right? So I see them migrate every now and then. And for a real-time game, that's actually not really great, but it works fairly well, so it's okay. And in particular, what I've seen is that you hot migrate the image and within like a second, it can respond again, or a few seconds. And I think that only works really because the image doesn't contain all the data, but the network attached disk can be pointed to from the new location easily.
Then what you're doing, that offline batch actually needs to be active all of the time, right? So it's not like an offline thing that it runs every day. It runs continuously.
It runs continuously,
Okay,
it's a constant
sense.
Feeding process. It's just that it's decoupled from the actual gameplay.
Okay, that makes total sense.
Right.
So this is interesting too. From like first glance, like talking about what we were talking about, like everything's sort of GCE, you're running your own sort of analytics pipeline. Probably the only managed service you're probably using is like cloud storage and maybe some load balancing. Was that a direct choice to basically use more of our infrastructure as a service, or like what was the reasoning behind that?
Well, the first approach was I have this hardware architecture that runs on bare metal, and now how do I make this run on the cloud, and then what services are there that could make it easier? So we were even looking at replacing Couchbase with DataStore, but of course our code makes too many requests, so that's not really feasible at this point in time, because before it was free and now there would be a transaction, each transaction costing a little bit. And so we ruled that one out. We also looked a lot into BigQuery because the Vertica machines eventually will run out of space, and there's the promise of higher performance by having more hardware and resources thrown at it from the Google side. And so that didn't pan out in the first iteration, so we didn't use that. But we needed to replace the file server with either a file server, but then we saw that it's much easier to use with Google Storage, and it's also kind of unbounded. I can just throw at it. It never says, oh, disk full, unlike the file server that then needs babysitting.
During the migration, did you just move the whole thing all of a sudden? Like you just got the whole system, stopped it from your on-prem and moved it to the cloud? Or
so
was it
We were actually in development when we made that decision on where to run. So we had previous games that were running on bare metal, and that still are, and that we have left behind when we moved companies around. And those are running great there, but I don't have to worry about those anymore. Mm-hmm. And so the new approach was, okay, we could do it the old-fashioned way, or we can do it the new way. And what really brings us the value besides the nice tools is that we can actually do a lot more load testing and development, where you can just put together a copy of the live system, or even a bigger system than the live system, and run it completely independent of the live system, and load test it for a few hours, 30, 40 servers, and then you shut them back down and you don't pay for them anymore after that. You can just delete them and they're gone. Whereas in the previous approach, we would have to have some dedicated test hardware. Yeah. And would always have to extrapolate what it probably would be like in a bigger version and so on. So it kind of opens up possibilities that just were not there before.
When you're doing these tests, how do you measure the performance? Are you using New Relic for this and tracking?
New Relic is one part of it, but New Relic is looking at individual transactions. But what I'm looking for is like volume,
yeah,
and throughput. So throughput. And so one open source tool that's really useful for that is JMeter.
Yeah.
It's written in Java, and it has a nice Java UI for basically making test plans and so on. And you run a system with just one web server, print out all the queries that come, all the posts that go through it when you test with your phone. And you basically see, okay, when my phone installs, these are the steps it will take. And then you can convert those into basically a JMeter test plan that can do that, like 1,000 of them in parallel. And then you run some of them on a few servers, and then you get basically 4,000 requests coming in, and you run it over and over again.
So is that just HTTP requests, or is that also stress testing against your battle servers, which I know is C++?
It's all implied, right? So the activity that you do is just like the phones would do. So it has consequences. Nice. Like, it's the same thing, basically. It starts the battles. It doesn't do the randomized stuff that real players would do, and there won't be the same kind of delays. But in order to get like a worst case scenario done, like if I really have 1 million installs a day of people that really play a lot,
yep.
Basically, then I can see how many servers do I need for that, and will it go down or will it survive? And so I'm looking at overall throughput of installs, and then I identify weak points, and I see, oh yeah, I need more of my battle servers than I thought, or I need to look at some of the requests slowing down suddenly because they're all focused too much on Redis and it's overloaded, stuff like that.
Cool. So I wonder, other than for the flexibility of being able to scale up and down and add like systems for testing and QA and stuff like that, what are other benefits that you've seen, or even what are the problems that you've seen by migrating to the cloud?
Challenges of migrating to the cloud, of course, at first is psychological, like there's
your machines.
Oh. Is this gonna go away overnight? And then what do I do, right? So of course we have backups that are basically proven, and I prove it to myself every now and then, and I can build a new system with the backup data and it actually still works. So that's a good thing. That again is something that the cloud really supports. The other challenge that we found was I was kind of like optimizing on hardware, and I was thinking I'd do the same optimizations on the cloud, but sometimes simpler is just better. So for the Couchbase server, for example, I was used to having like 2 RAID controllers, 4 volumes that are giving me maximum IOPS basically if I stripe across them. And so I tried the same approach on the cloud, and in theory that should really work, but in reality it was actually better to just use a single volume that is then larger and that is being handled by Google on the back end in order to maximize IOPS. And so that was one of the lessons learned, is basically don't try so hard to do the same optimizations because they might actually be in your way of success.
Yes. Go for the simple thing and then, like as you were saying, test it and find how to make it faster later. That's cool.
And the other one is don't try to use all the services up front. Like I said, we were learning a lot and spending a lot of time on which services to use. And the approach to first shift it into the cloud and then disassemble it later and look at, well, if I take this apart, can I actually use some of the services? Like initially, I was really thinking about a file server. That one I could rule out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But the Couchbase, that will take us a while to re-architect so that we don't have so many transactional costs, for example.
I wonder, you've migrated up to pretty like cloud-oriented point. Now you have all of these servers running on the cloud and everything. Are you planning on future migrations to other services? What is the future roadmap?
Well, the future is always wide open, right? So we are fast moving in terms of the features that we are using. I was looking just recently at the translation API. So I was thinking like, oh, we have all these international chats going. There are chat rooms in Italian, some in Chinese, some in Arabic. Wouldn't it be nice if you could look at basically what they are saying, besides having to have language domain experts in the company that can tell me? And so I was looking at that. So that's one interesting thing. And then, of course, we're always curious and learning more about machine learning. And every day you come up with new services and new stuff. So that's what we like about Google in general, is you guys are fast moving, just like we are, and very innovative and cutting edge. And so new options always come up.
I guess we're running out of time, according to Mark's hand gestures. So is there anything else that you'd like to mention that we might have missed?
One anecdote would be, and I hinted to that earlier, the tools that we use to basically prove out to ourselves that this is easy to use, and it was much easier than other cloud providers, led to the situation that we basically had a system that was meant as a prototype, but then was going to be put into production. And we were like, hey, can you do this tomorrow? And then they're like, well, you have infinite resources, but you have to negotiate a quota first. And quota is basically like your framework for how much will you potentially use. And it's kind of reserved resources so that they don't run out of resources just when you need them. And so I think engaging early to increase the quota when you want to go live, that's an important thing. And yeah, that was maybe one takeaway, is it's so easy that you could just move right into production quickly.
Are you working with customer engineers or sales engineers or any kind of those people in order to do those quotas, or is that completely automated?
Well, it's somewhat bureaucratic. So there's a form and you fill it out and then you talk about it. But you have very strong technical people and also a really good sales guy that I worked with, who understands the technology just as good as I do. And so it was really easy to talk with him about, okay, this is important to us and that one isn't. And then he made it happen on the back end and pushed it forward.
I guess that ties very well to all of our other episodes on customer engineers and sales engineers and customer reliability engineers and all that stuff.
Lots of resources. Yeah. That's generally what I like.
Wonderful. And so also make sure we'll get all the plugs in. You've got the app is out. So Guardian Kingdom is out on iOS and Android is coming soon.
Yes, definitely by the end of the year, you will see an Android version.
Cool. Wonderful. We'll have links in the show notes to the website so everyone who wants to go play the game can find it.
All right. Awesome. Play Guardian Kingdoms.
Yep. Fantastic. Well, Will, thank you so much for spending time with us and answering all our ridiculous questions, or maybe not so ridiculous. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, same here.
Thanks so much to Michael Will to spend some time today and tell us a little bit about the whole experience of migrating something as a hard to migrate a game environment from like very well-known hardware to the cloud and how everything worked out really well. Very, very cool.
Awesome. Yeah, no, thanks again to Michael. It was a really good story. And I think he had a really good take on the right steps to take when migrating and like when to make those trade-offs about, do I use the new things? Do I just continue with the what I know and then just make small steps, which they did. I thought that was a really, really interesting take. Why don't we move on to our question of the week?
And so the question is a pretty general one, but that has many answers and has a new one since not that long ago. So the question is, okay, how do I secure an App Engine application? And by securing it, I mean that only the people I want to access that web page will be able to access it. Like that is the only one that we care about right now.
Yep.
There is one, which is the typical one that I've been using forever, which is basically on your app.yaml, you can say login required or even login admin for a specific endpoint. So you can say, well, this web page here, you need to be logged in to access it. Now, if someone tries to access it and they're not logged in, what happens is that the App Engine framework will actually redirect that to a login page that only works for Google accounts, and then you need to log in there. And by Google accounts, I also mean Google apps. So if you have like at gcpodcast.com, for instance, one of those, it will log in and then go back to the same web page, and this time you will be authenticated, so it will work. Similarly, you can also say that logging is not required, but admin. And when you do this, not only you need to be authenticated, but you need to be also a owner of the project where that App Engine is hosted. So for instance, let's say that we added some kind of authentication for GCP podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody could authenticate to those, but only Mark and I would be able to use those that are marked as login admin. These are also very useful for when you're doing things like cron jobs. Cron jobs, this is one of the things that you really don't want anyone to be able to hit.
Yep.
Because in general, they're expensive. You don't want someone to go and hit like that once a second for the rest of the day.
And obscurity is not security.
It is not. It can help a little bit, but someone will find it at some point.
Yep.
It is important to be able to do required admin, stuff like that. So that is one of the options.
And it's worth noting that that only works with Google accounts.
Yes, it only works with the Google accounts. Google Apps accounts.
Yes. Yeah. So second way, I love what you've written here. You do you. I love that. So
everything goes, you do you.
Yep. So basically, build your own authentication into your app, right? Yep. Maybe use something like Datastore for the backend storage. Build your own OAuth provider. Hook into existing OAuth providers.
Store your passwords without even encrypting them. Don't use Salt. You know, you...
Whatever level that you are comfortable with, please don't do that.
Do not do that.
So more work, obviously, but that enables you full control over everything from how you want people to authenticate and what you want to build into.
And also, following the same idea of using OAuth 2, you do not need to implement the whole thing by yourself. OAuth 2 is kind of hard to implement. It's never fun. But there's providers that allow you to do this basically with zero effort. One of them, my favorite one, is Firebase Auth. Firebase Authentication will allow you to provide a very simple way of doing authentication using Auth 2. And not only with Google accounts, but also with like Facebook, Twitter, anything. They even support GitHub and stuff. They support a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And you don't need to do anything on your side. Everything you do is you receive a token and then you use a library to try to identify what a user is behind that token. Super cool. In a very similar way, Auth0 does something quite similar. So check those out if what you want to do is authentication with many different kinds of accounts and you don't really want to tie yourself to one provider.
So we also have this neat thing called the Identity Aware Proxy.
Yes, also known as BeyondCorp.
Yeah, mostly like internally. It. But yeah. So Identity Aware Proxy is actually kind of cool in that it is a layer that sits in front of App Engine, as well as some other products if you really want to, that enables you to basically control complete access based on who these people are. So you can set up roles and responsibilities. Again, this is linked to Google accounts, so keep that in mind. Yep. That if somebody comes in who's not meant to access this app, then they don't even get to like hit that URL. That never happens. And you can set up a bunch of rules. This is nice because not only can you apply it in one place, you could then apply it in multiple places around your organization from multiple apps as well, which is quite nice.
Yeah, it is really cool. Let's imagine that you have a company and that company has like 4 or 5 different applications and you want to use the same authentication schema for all of them, which, you know, makes sense. This is probably the easiest way to do it. Rather than having authentication in every single one of those apps, what you do is you protect those apps with the Cloud Identity Aware Proxy. Or actually, you could do both.
Yeah, you could do both. The nice thing in as well is the Identity Aware Proxy will pass through who the user is. So it not only provides access protection, but also has user, basically user login. You get that information as it comes through.
And one of the cool things is that this is something that will stop a request from getting to your application on the first place, unless it's been authenticated. So it's pretty good. App Engine, for instance, if you keep on hitting it, you will have an instance running.
Mm-hmm.
It might even scale up if you got a lot of traffic. If that traffic is not authenticated, that traffic will never hit your instance.
Yep.
So you're good.
So that's pretty cool. Now, if I want to lock it down to just a section of IPs.
Yes. So that's what we call a firewall. And that's the new thing. We have an App Engine firewall. And it is as simple as it sounds. It is a firewall where you can say only requests coming from this specific IP or this range of IPs is able to hit my app. If they're not coming from those IPs, they will be dropped, so your application will not receive any of that traffic.
Very nice. I think if I wanted to use these in combo, I would probably do something like Cloud Identity Aware Proxy plus an App Engine firewall. So if I've got, say, a corporate network, I know what my IP range is, so I know, okay, this can only come from within these IP ranges. And then IAP on top of that so that I have both layers. Maybe if I accidentally misconfigure IAP, I still have the added protection of the IP range and vice versa.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that Cloud Identity Aware Proxy is secure enough.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, but Cloud Identity Aware Proxy, it makes it so you need to authenticate. So probably what I would do is use Cloud Antiware proxy for all the things where users are using it, but then use App Engine Firewall for when you have like a different system that is hitting you and you know what IP you're using.
Maybe,
so it's like only that can, like kind of like a remote cron job or something like that.
You could do that too.
It could help, I think. But yeah.
There's probably lots of layers you could put this stuff together.
Actually, maybe we should do an episode on this.
It would be cool.
Because that was a lot of information.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So you got lots of fun tools to play with. But before we wrap up today, Francesc, what are you up to? What are you doing? Where are you going? What's happening?
I'm going to the land of kangaroos and Woo! Koalas. I'm going to Australia for the Cloud Summit in Sydney, which will take place Wednesday 13
yep.
of September. After that, I'll be back for a week, and then I'll go to next in Chicago, where I'll be speaking about TensorFlow. I'm very excited. I'm doing a lot of machine learning.
Nice.
Lately,
you look so like you're enjoying that.
I know. I'm going to be speaking about TensorFlow and how to use it.
Sweet.
And then in October, I'll be to Velocity in London to speak about performance profiling with Go.
Nice.
What about you?
So when this episode comes out, I'll be on the second day of PAX Dev, and then I'll be attending PAX West, playing all the games with all my friends, which I'm super excited about. Then after that, I have GameCon Las Vegas in September, as well as Austin Game Conference, and then attending Strange Loop. And strangely enough as well, no pun intended, actually. There.
Wow.
Yeah, that's great. So in October, I will be heading to Australia as well. So I will be speaking at DevFest Melbourne, which is in October. So the, what do I have, 21st of October. But then I'll be doing all the stuff at Melbourne International Games Week. So I'm speaking at GCAP, Game Connect Asia Pacific. I'm hoping to speak at PAX Australia, we shall see. But at the very least, I'll be there, and I'll also be at Unite Melbourne as well.
Nice.
So if anyone wants to say hello, drop me a line.
I got to congratulate you on your very native pronunciation of Melbourne.
Well, I did live there for most of my life.
It sounds very, very, very local. I like it. Yeah.
Awesome. So, Francesc, thank you so much for joining me yet again for another episode of the podcast.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you all for listening.
And we'll see you all next week.
See you all next week.